The outline of my talk today is going to start with an introduction and then go on to turfgrass utilization or usage in urban areas, and then some best management practices that are discussed and provided to growers and turfgrass managers by our outreach and education programs, and then a summary. But I'd like to start with the introductory quiz. I know you guys are all going to get 100% because you've been here for a while. The Susquehanna River is A, the largest Chesapeake Bay tributary, B, the largest nutrient source of the bay, C, flowing at an average rate of 70 megaliters per minute at Harvey Garce, or the main outlet of a watershed that is home to nearly 4 million people, or E, all of the above. All right, that's correct. So it's a unique basin, and we certainly have to do our best to educate and instruct turfgrass managers to take care of the basin. Here's an image that I'm sure you've seen already today, showing the Susquehanna River Basin and the legend of development and natural vegetated area cultivation. And as you can see, a majority of the cultivation and development is concentrated in the lower basin there in the southern central Pennsylvania region. And this is an image that focuses on that lower basin region. And I was going to take some information from a publication that is probably pretty dated at this point, but it was easily accessible by me and so well written I couldn't help but cite from it. And that was a study that was conducted in the 90s and published in 1998 by the U.S. Geological Survey that showed the nitrate in the surface and groundwater of the urban Great Valley region. And the Great Valley is this region right here. It's just the southernmost calcium carbonate underlaid valley of the Ridge and Valley physiographic region there and home to Harrisburg. And the study found that both surface and groundwater of the urban Great Valley region was low relative to agricultural similar regions, like the western portion of the Great Valley and also other portions of the lower basin. So that's good to hear that the fertilization that's going on in urban areas to home lawns is not resulting in the highest concentrations observed, but the levels weren't zero. They were below the MCL, but they were still measurable. And if we take a look here, October 22nd, 2001, it was a nice day for a satellite flyby. This is a Landsat image of Harrisburg. And you can see here that this is the urbanized region of Harrisburg and the Great Valley region. And it's underlaid with the bedrock, calcium carbonate bedrock. And then as you head west, you come into less urban development and more agricultural usage. And you know, these areas here were recording higher nitrate concentrations than these. But again, these weren't zero. So it's very possible that fertilization of turfgrass may have resulted in the levels observed. And the same report I mentioned earlier showed that total PNN levels in the Susquehanna River trended downwards during a period of rapid housing development in the lower basin from 1985 to 1996. So that's good because that doesn't necessarily implicate installation of turfgrass and management of turfgrass as a source of increased nutrients in the river. So what they did conclude was that urban centers underlain by the calcium carbonate or crystalline bedrock were the primary sources of VOCs in groundwater. And although there might be a couple leaky tanks on golf courses somewhere where we have facilities with equipment, I don't suspect that turfgrass is responsible for a whole lot of the VOCs, but the turfgrass regions were minor sources of nitrate and non-agricultural pesticides in both surface and groundwater. I mean, at least the urban centers were where turfgrass is a common land usage. And then turbidity, which is associated with land development and installation of turfgrass and runoff events, was not assessed, but hopefully our outreach efforts continue to keep those contributions to the river at a minimum. But all things considered, any contribution of nitrogen, phosphorus, pesticides, or sediment to the Susquehanna River from turfgrass systems is too much and should be reduced. And as a educator. I've been certainly doing my part and assisting in the development of programs to get the word out. Because where people go, they tend to install turf grass. And this is a picture of Lancaster from that same satellite flyby. And you can see here that this was done in 2001, but you can see golf course right there. And there's a golf course here. And a golf course up here. So what has been agricultural usage has been converted to turf grass usage, and the same is true for these areas here that were undoubtedly agricultural areas at one point and are now, you know, subdivisions. So there has been an increase in turf grass usage in the basin, and the same is true for York. This is the same same flyby image. I hope you guys like this. It took about 3 hours for me to download this off of the USGS site, and then another hour for Photoshop to open it. But boy, have I spent a lot of time playing around with them. Again, you can see golf course here, another golf course here, another golf course here. So there certainly there's been a transition from agricultural land to turf grass. And for that reason, and because of the influence of non-point sources on the river quality, these need to be addressed with some best management practices. Because wherever turf grass grows, cultural inputs follow. Here's a sprayer that these pieces of equipment are used to apply insecticides, herbicides, fungicides. And with the insecticides and the herbicides being of the most concern regarding levels of pesticides in the river. And then, of course, there's also fertilization that goes on and that contributes nitrogen and phosphorus to, you know, potentially to groundwater and surface waters. And then there's large-scale fertilizer applications of turf grass that goes on in golf courses and athletic fields. Now, we really encourage the people that we educate and train to do this stuff right. But invariably, nitrogen fertilizer and phosphorus fertilizer is misapplied, and this pains me too. I really hope this wasn't a Penn State graduate, but this is an aerial view of a turf grass. It is right on a, right adjacent to a surface water, and you can see that the fertilizer was not properly applied. And this is the type of thing that really horrifies all of us, and something that we're really making an effort to minimize. And this is done through the dissemination of best turf grass management practices. And I'll just kind of run through these really quickly. I'll try to get us back on time. A nice thing to do with residential areas is to leave a ring of responsibility. And that's for turf grass areas that are bordered by surface water resources. Just we encourage people not to fertilize those areas. There's deflector shields that are available for turf grass spreaders. But my philosophy is the spreader should not even be close enough to the water for a deflector shield to make a difference. Just keep the spreaders away from the water and just tolerate some some nutrient deficient turf grass. But this is also useful where you have impervious surfaces. And when homeowners do apply turf fertilizers to turf grasses, invariably it's going to land on the sidewalk. This is actually my wife and my home, my little 0.3 acres of bliss in the Valley of Happy. And we do brush off all of our impervious surfaces immediately following an application. And this is something that we also instruct our students and send this message through outreach. And you can do this on a large scale, too, with a blower. And then there's also some synergistic cultural practices that can be used to improve nutrient or fertilizer use efficiency. And, we have an issue in turf grass, which is the development of thatch, and we use physical cultivation to remove that thatch, either core aerification, which you've probably seen before if you play golf or if you work on a campus, and then this is verticutting, which uses vertical-oriented knives to do the same thing. But what there's been several studies that have found when phosphorus fertilizers, slow-release phosphorus fertilizers like triple superphosphate, are applied to sloping areas, when they're applied immediately following a core aerification procedure, they tend to be stabilized in the soil profile and less prone to runoff. And also there's a delay in runoff events in systems that are sloped that have been core aerified because the air surface area has been increased. So these are good practices to use. Of course, We wouldn't encourage someone to core aerify an area, a sloping bank that would go right down into a river. That would, undeniably result in some sediment transport. But in areas where there are surface waters nearby, this tends to minimize the, or at least delay, runoff events. And then, cultural practice is just efficient irrigation, making sure that your irrigation is adequately spaced. And then, a common adage or a common philosophy is to apply fertilizer right before big rain. And we've been really encouraging people not to do this anymore. The best way to activate an application of fertilizer is really to irrigate it in with a very, very small amount of irrigation following the application. Just enough to solubilize it, but not enough to instigate a runoff or a leaching event. And in the weeks following a fertilizer application, only enough irrigation should be applied to replace the evapotranspirational losses. And we are also encouraging people to reapply fertilizers frequently at lower rates, or using split applications, and also to supplant nitrogen with other micronutrients. In these plots here, this picture was taken earlier on a golf course, a research putting green. All of these plots have been treated with the exact amount of nitrogen for a 3-month period. But some of the differences between the color and the growth are associated with iron and potassium and manganese inclusions in these liquid products. So there's a lot of headway to be made, minimizing nitrogen applications, supplanting the nitrogen with other micronutrients that provide a color response. And I've been disseminating as much of this information as possible. And then also, advances in technology and construction anyhow, we're really trying to discourage architects and turfgrass managers from maintaining turf right to surface water resources. What we're now encouraging are these buffer strips, and these are a tremendous improvement, ideally with native plantings that can intercept both sediment and nutrient flow. And then remote sensing is a promising technological advance, real-time nutrient sufficiency assessment using multispectral radiometers and the like, and then making fertilizer applications in real time, with real time feedback. There's still a little ways to go there, but it's certainly something we look forward to in improving fertilizer use efficiency. And then slow release fertilizer formulations are more expensive than urea and ammonium nitrate, but they do improve recovery in the weeks following the fertilizer application. For example, this was uptake of Kentucky bluegrass nitrogen uptake in the 7 to 12 week period following an application of granular nitrogen, and there was a significant quantity of nitrogen recovered in this 7 to 12 week period where slow release formulations had been used, compared to Mesa and Stagreen, which are pretty much urea based materials. So there's promise there. The fertilizers are expensive, but they do improve recovery following applications of granular fertilizers. And then also turf type tall fescue, I think, is one of the greatest advances we've had in some time. It's a very deep-rooted turf grass. It's very resistant to drought. It's endophyte enhanced so that it has insect tolerance, insect damage tolerance, and it has very low nitrogen requirements. So we're encouraging people to replace Kentucky bluegrass and perennial ryegrass with this species when possible. And that's where the whole plan words went with the grassroots movement, deeper roots with tall fescue. And certainly that's going to improve or at least minimize leaching of nitrate and other constituents. And then growth regulation using gibberellic acid inhibitors at very, very low rates applied to the foliage has been shown to minimize nitrogen requirements and minimize growth and allow lower amounts of nutrients to be concentrated in tissue. So to summarize, with urbanization comes turfgrass management. Everyone likes a nice turfgrass lawn. Potential for non-point nutrient pesticides is obviously a very concern, contributions from turfgrass. What we have done to minimize the potential of this non-point contributions are to educate and outreach our managers and our students to use improved species, proper application timing, clean up and water in fertilizers with modest amounts of irrigation, regulate growth where appropriate, and supplant nitrogen with iron where appropriate, and just greater cognizance of the great resource that the Susquehanna River is. Thank you very much.